into the runabout and hoisted himself over the side. He pulled off a loose overcoat, revealing a dive tank and weight belt that he quickly unbuckled. Stripping out of the dry suit, he threw on some dry clothes, started the outboard, and quickly sped past the sailboat. On board the dinghy, the Black Lab barked morosely as it eyed its owner drifting lifelessly off the stern. The man gazed at the dog without pity, then turned from the scene of death and calmly cruised toward Victoria. Chapter 5. The Ventura's arrival at its home port of Kitimat created an immediate stir. Most of the hamlet's 11,000 residents knew the dead fishermen as neighbors, friends, or acquaintances. It was only minutes after Dirk docked the boat at the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Wharf that word leaked out to the local townspeople. Family and friends quickly assembled on the dock until being pushed behind a temporary barricade erected by a bull-sized Mountie. Tying up the Numa research boat just astern, Summer joined her brother, attracting curious gazes from the nearby onlookers. A hospital van was backed down the dock, and the three bodies loaded aboard on covered stretchers. In a dingy bait shack a few feet away, Dirk and Summer chronicled their morbid discovery.
"All three were dead when you went aboard?"
The monotonous tone of the questioner's voice matched his face. Kitimat's police chief peered at Dirk and Summer with unblinking gray eyes that glared over a small nose and an expressionless mouth. Dirk had immediately pegged the inspector as a frustrated lawman trapped in a job too small for his ambitions.
"Yes," Dirk replied. "First thing I did was check for a pulse, but it was evident by their color and skin temperature that they had died at least a short while before I got aboard."
"Did you move the bodies?"
"No. I just covered them up with some blankets when we got close to port. They looked to me like they died where they fell." The chief nodded blankly.
"Did you hear any distress calls on the radio beforehand? And were there any other vessels in the area?"
"We heard no calls on the radio," Summer replied.
"The only other vessel I noted was a cruise ship sailing down the passage. She was several miles to the north of us when we found the Ventura," Dirk added.
The chief stared at them for an awkward minute, then closed a small notebook he had been scribbling in.
"What do you think happened?" he asked, arching brows, finally cracking his stone face.
"I'll leave that for the pathologists to determine," Dirk said, "though if you forced me to guess, I'd say carbon monoxide poisoning. Maybe an exhaust leak under the wheelhouse allowed gases to accumulate inside.
They were all found together in the bridge, so it might figure," the chief nodded. "You don't feel any ill effects?"
"I'm fine. Opened all the windows, just to be safe."
"Anything else you can tell me that might be of help?"
Dirk looked up for a moment, then nodded.
"There's the odd message on the footwell."
The chief's brows arched again.
"Show me."
Dirk led him and Summer onto the Ventura and into the bridge. Standing near the wheel, he poked a toe toward the helm. The chief dropped to his knees for a closer look, disturbed that he had missed something during his initial crime scene investigation. A faint, penciled inscription was scribbled on the face of the helm, just a few inches above the deck. It was a spot where a prone man dying on the deck might try to leave a last message. The inspector pulled out a flashlight and aimed it at the inscription. In a shaky hand was spelled the word "choked," with a small gap in front of the D. The chief reached over and picked up a yellow pencil that had rolled against the bulkhead. "The writing was in reach of the captain's body," Dirk said. "Maybe he fell quickly and couldn't reach the radio." The chief grunted, still upset he had missed it earlier.
"Doesn't mean much. Might have already been there."
He turned and stared at Dirk and Summer.
"What is your business in Hecate Strait?" he asked.
"We are with the National Underwater and Marine Agency, conducting a study of phytoplankton health along the inside passage," Summer explained. "We are sampling the waters between Juneau and Vancouver at the request of the Canadian Fisheries Department."
The inspector looked at the Numa boat, then nodded.
I'm going to have to ask you people to stay here in Kitimat for a day or two until the preliminary investigation is complete. You can keep your boat tied up here. This is a municipal dock. There's a motel just a block or two up the road, if you need it. Why don't you plan on coming by my office tomorrow afternoon around 3? I'll send a car to pick you up.
Glad to be of help, Dirk replied dryly, slightly annoyed at being treated as potential suspects. Their interview complete, Dirk and Summer jumped to the dock and started walking back to their boat. They looked up as a fiberglass workboat nearly identical to their own came roaring toward the dock. The pilot brought it in way too fast, the bow kissing the dock hard just seconds after the engines had been cut. A tall man in a flannel shirt burst from the wheelhouse, grabbed a bowline, and leaped to the dock. Quickly tying the line behind the Numa boat, he stomped along the pier, his boots pounding the wooden planks. Summer noted his rugged features and shaggy hair as he approached, but sensed a measure of grace in his wide, dark eyes.
"Are you the folks who found the Ventura?" he asked, giving Dirk and Summer a hard stare. The voice was refined and articulate, which seemed to Summer an odd contrast to the man's appearance.
"Yes," Dirk replied. "I brought her into port." The man nodded briskly, then stormed down the dock, catching the police inspector as he stepped ashore. Summer watched as the man engaged the Mountie in an animated conversation, their voices elevating to a high pitch.
"Can't say we've had the warmest of welcomes," Dirk muttered, climbing into the Numa vessel. "Does everybody here have the demeanor of a grizzly bear?" "Guess we brought too much drama to sleepy little Kitimat," Summer replied. Securing their boat and retrieving their water samples, they headed into the Northwoods town, finding it not so sleepy after all. A mini-boom was taking place in Kitimat, an outgrowth of the deep-water port facility located southwest of downtown. International industry had quietly taken notice of the shipping capabilities and was turning the town into the busiest Canadian port north of Vancouver. A longtime Alcon aluminum smelter had recently undergone a billion-dollar expansion, while logging operations and tourism continued to grow. Locating a shipping office, they overnighted their water samples to a Numa lab facility in Seattle, then grabbed a late dinner. Walking back to their motel, they took a detour to the dock to retrieve a few items from the boat. Standing on the bridge, Summer found herself staring at the Ventura moored in front of them. The police had finished their investigation and the boat sat empty, a silent blanket of morbidity hanging over it. Dirk stepped up from below decks, noticing his sister's concentration. "Can't do anything to bring them back," he said.
"It's been a long day. Let's head to the motel and turn in."
"Just thinking about that message on the footwell and what the captain was trying to say. I wonder if it was a warning of some sort."
"They died quickly. We don't even know if it was a last message." Summer thought about the inscription again and shook her head. It meant something more than it appeared. That much she was certain. Beyond that, she had no clue. Somehow, she told herself, she would figure it out.
Chapter 6. The restaurant's decor would never be featured in Architectural Digest, Dirk thought, but the smoked salmon and eggs certainly rated 5 stars. He grinned at the moose head protruding above Summer as he swallowed another bite of breakfast. The moose was only one of a dozen stuffed animal heads mounted on the wall. Each seemed to be staring at Summer through hard, glassy eyes.
"All this roadkill is enough to make a person turn vegan," Summer grimaced, shaking her head at the bared snout of a grizzly bear.
"Kitimat's taxidermist must be the richest guy in town," Dirk replied.
"Probably owns the motel."
She sipped at a cup of coffee as the door to the cafe opened and a tall man entered the restaurant. He strode directly to their table as Dirk and Summer recognized him as the agitated man they'd encountered on the dock the day before.
"May I please join you?" he asked in a non-threatening manner.
"Please do," Dirk said, pushing out a chair. He stuck his hand out at the stranger. "I'm Dirk Pitt. This is my sister Summer." The man's brow rose a fraction as he gazed at Summer.
"Glad to know you," he replied, shaking hands.
"My name is Trevor Miller. My older brother Steve was captain of the Ventura."
We're sorry for what happened yesterday, Summer replied. She could tell by the look in the man's eyes that he was deeply shaken by the loss of his brother.
He was a good man, Trevor said, his gaze turning distant. He then looked at Summer and offered a sheepish grin.
My apologies for the gruff behavior yesterday. I had just received word of my brother's death over the marine radio and was a little upset and confused.
A natural reaction, Summer said.
I think we were all a little confused.
Trevor inquired about their involvement, and Summer told of their discovery of the fishing boat while surveying the Hecate Strait.
Your brother fished these waters for some time? Dirk asked.
No, only 2 or 3 years.
He was actually a doctor who sold his practice and turned to fishing out of passion. Did pretty well at it, too, despite all the restrictions placed on commercial fishing these days to protect the stocks.
Seems like an odd career transition, Summer remarked.
We grew up on the water. Our father was an engineer for the local mining company and an avid fisherman. We traveled around a lot, but always had a boat. Steve would be on the water every chance he got. He even crewed on a trawler in high school.
He sure kept a smart boat, Dirk said. I've never seen such an immaculate fishing boat.
The Ventura was the pride of the Northwest, he used to joke. Steve was a bit of a perfectionist. He always kept his boat spotless and his equipment maintained in the highest order.
That's what makes everything so troubling.
He gazed out the window, a faraway look in his eyes. Then he turned to Dirk and asked quietly,
They were dead when you found them?
I'm afraid so. The boat was circling haphazardly with no one at the helm when we first spotted it.
The Ventura would have piled onto the rocks of Guild Island if Dirk hadn't jumped aboard, Summer added.
I'm glad you did, Trevor said. The autopsies revealed that the men died of asphyxiation. The police are certain that carbon monoxide poisoning was the cause. Yet I went all over the Ventura and could find no evidence of an exhaust leak.
The engine is well astern of the wheelhouse, which makes it perplexing.
Perhaps there is no leak and it was just an odd mix of wind and running conditions that allowed the exhaust fumes to accumulate in the cabin, Dirk suggested. It does seem odd that the three men succumbed so quickly.
It might not be that unusual, Summer said. There was a mystery several years ago when a high number of drowning deaths began plaguing houseboat vacationers on Lake Powell. They finally discovered that exhaust fumes were accumulating off the stern of the houseboats and incapacitating swimmers in the water.
Steve was such a cautious man, Miller noted.
It's not difficult to be overcome by an unseen killer, Dirk said.
The discussion was taking a toll on Trevor, and he physically paled from the strain. Summer poured him a cup of coffee and tried to move the conversation elsewhere.
If there is anything we can do to help, please ask, she said, her soft gray eyes showing genuine concern.
Thank you for trying to help my brother and his crew, and for saving the Ventura.
My family is grateful.
Trevor hesitated, then added, There is one favor I would like to ask you. I wonder if you would consider taking me to the site where you found them.
It's over 50 miles from here, Dirk said.
We can take my boat. She cruises at 25 knots. I'd just like to see where he was at the time.
Summer glanced at a clock mounted beneath a sneering mountain lion. We don't have to meet with the police inspector until 3 o'clock, she said to her brother. We might be able to make a quick run out and back.
I need to check out the ROV and see if we get anything back from the Seattle lab, Dirk replied. How about you go with Mr. Miller and I'll handle the inspector in case you're late getting back?
Call me Trevor.
And I'll have her back on time, Trevor said, smiling at Summer as if he were asking her father's permission to take her out. She was surprised to feel a slight blush cross her cheeks.
Save me a seat under the hot interrogation light, she said to Dirk, rising from her chair. I'll see you at 3.
Chapter 7 Trevor helped Summer aboard his boat, then quickly cast off the lines. As the workboat edged away from the dock, she leaned over the side and noted a Natural Resources Canada logo painted on the hull.
When the boat had safely slipped past the port dockage and was speeding down Douglas Channel, Summer walked into the cabin and sat on a bench near the pilot's seat.
"What do you do for the Natural Resources Department?" she asked.
"Coastal ecologist for the department's forestry service," he replied, steering around a logging ship chugging down the center of the channel. "I work mostly with industrial concerns in the northern British Columbia coastal region. I have been fortunate to base out of Kitimat, since the ongoing port expansion provides plenty of activity." He turned to Summer and smiled. "Tame stuff compared to what you and your brother do for NUMA, I'm sure." "Collecting plankton samples along the inside passage isn't too wild and crazy," she replied. "I would be interested in seeing your results. We've had reports of concentrated marine mortality in a few areas around here, though I've never been able to successfully document the occurrences." "Be only too happy to work with a fellow disciple of the deep," she laughed. The boat snaked through the winding channel at high speed, gliding easily over the calm water. Green fingers of land laden with thick pines jutted into the sound, a series of scenic obstacles. Following their progress on a navigation chart, Summer instructed Trevor to slow as they entered the main cross-channel of Hecate Strait. A brief rain shower pelted them for a few minutes, leaving them in a gray gloom. Approaching Gill Island, the rain lifted, increasing visibility to a mile or two. Looking from the radar to the horizon, Summer could see that there were no other vessels around them. "Here, let me steer," Summer said, standing and putting a hand on the wheel. Trevor gave her a reluctant look, then stood and stepped aside. Summer angled the boat towards the island, then slowed and swung north. "We were situated about here when we noticed the Ventura running from the northwest, a mile or so off. She made a lazy turn, gradually coming up on our beam. Would have struck us if we hadn't jumped off her path." Trevor stared out the window, trying to visualize the scene. "I had just taken a water sample. We saw no one at the helm, and a radio call went unanswered. I brought us alongside, and Dirk was able to jump aboard. That's when he found your brother," she said, her voice trailing off. Trevor nodded, then walked to the stern deck and gazed across the water. A light drizzle began to fall, streaming his face with moisture. Summer left him alone with his thoughts for several minutes, then approached quietly and grabbed his hand. "I'm sorry about your brother," she said softly. He squeezed her hand but continued staring off in the distance. His eyes suddenly sharpened as he focused on something nearby. A white cloud had materialized on the water a few dozen yards off the bow. The vapor grew rapidly until it encroached upon the boat. "Awfully white for a fog bank," Summer said with a curious look. She noted that the air took on a pungent odor as the mist drew closer. The cloud had billowed to the tip of the bow when the light drizzle overhead suddenly thickened into a downpour. Trevor and Summer ducked into the wheelhouse as a deluge of rainwater pelted the boat. Through the window, they watched the approaching white cloud disappear under the gray canopy of falling water. "That was odd," Summer remarked as Trevor fired up the motor. He aimed the boat toward Kitimat, applying a heavy throttle as he noticed a scattering of dead fish whir by in the water. "Devil's breath," he said quietly.
"Devil's what?"
"Devil's breath," he repeated, turning a troubled eye toward Summer. "A local native Haizla was fishing in this area a few weeks ago and washed up dead on one of the islands. The authorities said he drowned, possibly run over by a vessel that didn't see him in the fog. Maybe he had a heart attack, I don't really know." The rain outside had let up, but Trevor kept his eyes on the boat's path ahead.
"Go on,"
Summer prodded after a lengthy pause. "I never thought much about it. But a few days ago, my brother recovered the man's skiff while fishing out here and asked me to return it to the family. The man had lived in Kitimat Village, a Haizla settlement. I had done some water studies for the village, so was friendly with a number of residents. When I met with the family, the deceased man's uncle kept crying that devil's breath had killed him."
"What did he mean?"
"He said that the devil had decided his time had come and cast down a cold white breath of death that killed him and everything around him."
"The reported fish?" And marine life kills?
Trevor turned and gave Summer a half grin. I'm pretty sure the old guy was drunk when he told me that. The Haizla have no shortage of supernatural deeds in their storytelling.
It does sound like an old wives' tale,
Summer agreed. But her words didn't stop a sudden chill from tingling up her spine. The rest of the journey was made in silence, as they both contemplated the strange words of the Haizla native and how it fit with the things they had seen.
They were within a few miles of Kitimat when an executive helicopter whisked across their bow low overhead. The chopper angled toward a protruding chunk of land on the north bank, where an industrial facility was nestled in the trees. A wooden pier stretched into the sound, berthing several small boats and a large luxury yacht. On an adjacent grass clearing was pitched a large white party tent.
Private hunting lodge for the rich and famous?
Summer asked with a tilt of her head.
Nothing that glamorous. It's actually a prototype carbon sequestration plant built by Terra Green Industries. I was involved in some of the site approval and inspection work as it was being built.
I'm familiar with the concept of carbon sequestration. Collecting and liquefying industrial carbon dioxide gases and pumping them deep into the earth or beneath the ocean floor. Seems like an expensive way to keep pollutants out of the atmosphere.
The new greenhouse gas emission limits make it a hot technology. The clampdown on industrial carbon dioxide releases in Canada is especially stringent. Companies can now trade carbon credits, but the cost is much higher than many had anticipated. Mining and power companies are particularly desperate to find lower-cost alternatives. Goyette expects to make a lot of money from his sequestration technology if he is allowed to expand the process.
Mitchell Goyette? The environmental magnate?
Yes, he's the owner of Terra Green. Goyette is something of a cultural hero to many Canadians. He's built dams, wind farms, and solar panel fields all over the country while touting hydrogen fuel technologies.
I'm familiar with his call for offshore wind farms along the Atlantic seaboard to produce clean energy.
I have to tell you, that doesn't exactly look like a hydrogen-powered yacht, Summer said, pointing toward the Italian-built luxury vessel.
No, he doesn't live the self-deprived life of a true greenie. He's become a billionaire off the environmental movement, yet nobody holds it against him. Some people say that he doesn't even believe in the movement, that it's just a means for him to make money.
Apparently he has succeeded, she said, still eyeing the yacht. Why did he build a sequestration facility here?
In a word, Athabasca. The oil sands of Athabasca, Alberta, require a tremendous amount of energy to refine into crude oil. A byproduct of the process is carbon dioxide, apparently in large quantities. The new greenhouse gas agreement will shut down the refinery operations unless they can find a way around their CO2 problem. Enter Mitchell Goyette. The oil companies were already building a small pipeline from the oil fields to Kitimat. Goyette convinced them to build an extra pipeline to run liquefied carbon dioxide.
We noticed a pair of small oil tankers in the channel, Summer said.
We fought the pipelines hard for fear of oil spills, but the commerce powers won out. Goyette, meanwhile, convinced the government that a coastal location was key for his facility and even received a land grant from the Natural Resources Department.
A shame it ended up in such a pristine location.
There was a lot of dissent in the department, but the Natural Resources Minister ultimately signed off on it. In fact, I'm told he is one of the guests visiting the official grand opening today.
And you didn't make the cut? Summer asked.
My invitation must have gotten lost in the mail. No, wait. The dog ate it.
He laughed. It was the first time Summer had caught Trevor in a light moment, and she observed a sudden warmth in his eyes. They sped on into Kitimat, Trevor easing the boat to berth behind the docked Numa vessel.
Dirk could be seen inside the research vessel's cabin, typing on a laptop computer. He closed the computer and stepped out with a morose look on his face as Summer and Trevor tied up the other vessel, then walked alongside.
Back before 3, with room to spare, Summer greeted, eyeing her wristwatch.
I think the police chief's visit is the least of our worries, Dirk replied. I just downloaded the lab results from the water samples we sent to Seattle yesterday.
Why so glum?
Dirk handed the printout to Summer, then gazed across the waters of the Sound. The pristine-looking waters lying off Kitimat are threatening to kill anything that swims through it. Chapter 8 Mitchell Goyet drained the glass of Krug Clos de Menil champagne with a smug look of satisfaction. He placed the empty crystal flute on a cocktail table just as the wash from the helicopter's rotor rippled the tent overhead.
"Excuse me, gentlemen," he said in a deep voice. "That would be the Prime Minister."
Extricating himself from a small group of regional province politicians, Goyet exited the tent and strode toward a nearby landing pad. A large and imposing man, Goyet had a polished demeanor that bordered on slick. With wide eyes, greased back hair, and a permanent grin, he carried the look of a wild boar. Yet he moved in a fluid, almost graceful manner that belied his simmering arrogance. It was the conceit of a man who had amassed his wealth through shrewdness, deceit, and intimidation. Though not a rags-to-riches product, Goyet had parlayed a family land inheritance into a small fortune when a power company solicited a portion of the site for a proposed hydroelectric project. Goyet astutely negotiated a percentage of the power revenues for use of the land, correctly predicting the insatiable power demands of a booming Vancouver. He leveraged one investment after another, acquiring mineral and logging rights, thermal power resources, and his own hydroelectric plants. A powerful publicity campaign carefully focused on his alternative energy holdings and painted him as a man of the people in order to increase his negotiating strength with the government powers. With his assets privately held, few knew of his major holdings in gas, coal, and oil properties, and the complete hypocrisy of his carefully cultivated image. Goyet watched as the Sikorsky S-76 hovered briefly, then touched its wheels down onto a wide circular landing pad. The twin engines were shut down, then the co-pilot climbed out and opened the side passenger door. A short man with shiny silver hair stepped out and held his head low under the swirling rotor blades as two aides followed him close behind.
"Mr. Prime Minister, welcome to Kitimat and our new Terra Green facility," Goyet greeted with an extra-wide smile. "How was your flight?"
"That's one plush bird. I'm just glad the rain let up so we could enjoy the view."
The Canadian Prime Minister, a polished man in his own right named Barrett, reached over and shook Goyet's hand.
"Good to see you again, Mitch, and thanks for the lift. I didn't realize that you were also abducting one of my own cabinet members."
He motioned toward a droopy-eyed man with a receding hairline who stepped off the chopper and approached the group.
"Natural Resources Minister Jameson was instrumental in approving our facility here," Goyet beamed.
"Welcome to the finished product," he added, turning to Jameson. The Resources Minister didn't return the exuberance. With a forced grin, he replied,
"I'm happy to see the facility operational."
"The first of many, with your help," Goyet said, winking at the Prime Minister.
"Yes, your firm's capital planning director tells us that you already have a site under development in New Brunswick."
Barrett pointed back towards the helicopter.
"My capital planning director?" Goyet asked in a confused tone.
He followed the Prime Minister's gaze and turned toward the helicopter. Another man exited the side door and stretched his arms skyward. He crinkled his dark eyes at a fleeting burst of sunlight, then ran a hand through his short-cropped hair. The tailored blue suit he wore failed to hide his muscular build, but passed the mark for corporate executive attire. Goyet had to fight to keep his jaw from dropping as the man approached.
"Mr. Goyet," he grinned with a self-confident smile, "I have the papers on our Vancouver property divestiture for your signature."
He tapped a leather satchel held under one arm for effect.
"Excellent," Goyet snorted, regaining his composure at the sight of his hired hitman strolling off his private helicopter. "Why don't you wait in the plant manager's office and we'll attend to it shortly?"
Goyet turned and hurriedly escorted the Prime Minister into the white tent.
Wine and hors d'oeuvres were served to the accompaniment of a string quartet before Goyette led the dignitaries to the entrance of the sequestration facility. A droll-faced engineer identified as the plant manager took charge of the group and led them on a short tour. They walked through two large pump stations, then moved outside, where the plant manager pointed out several mammoth holding tanks that were partially concealed in the surrounding pines.
The carbon dioxide is pumped as a liquid from Alberta and received into the holding tanks, the manager explained. It is then pumped under pressure into the ground beneath us. An 800-meter well was dug here, driving through a thick layer of caprock until reaching a porous sedimentary formation filled with brine. It is the ideal geology to hold CO2 and virtually impervious to surface leakage.
What would happen if an earthquake should strike here? The Prime Minister asked.
We are at least 30 miles from the nearest known fault line, so the odds of a large quake occurring here are quite remote. And at the depths we are storing the product, there is virtually no chance of an accidental release from a geological event.
And exactly how much of the Athabasca refinery's carbon dioxide output are we sequestering here?
Just a fraction, I'm afraid. We'll need many more facilities to absorb the full output from the oil sand fields and allow them to operate at peak production again.
Goyette capitalized on a line of questioning to insert a sales pitch.
As you know, Alberta oil production has had to face serious cutbacks because of the tighter carbon emission mandate. The situation is equally dire for the coal-fired power plants back east. The economic impact to the country will be enormous. But you are standing at the heart of the solution. We've already scouted more locations in the region that are suitable for sequestration facilities. All we need is your help to move forward.
Perhaps. But I'm not sure I like the idea of British Columbia's coastline being a receptacle for Alberta's industrial pollution, the Prime Minister said dryly. A product of Vancouver, he still had a homegrown pride in his native province.
Don't forget the tax that British Columbia imposes for each metric ton of carbon transferred across its border, a fraction of which goes back to the federal coffers. The fact is, it is a safe money-making play for the province. Plus, you may have noticed our dock facility. Goyette pointed to a huge covered building across the grounds that sat adjacent to a small inlet. We have a 500-foot covered dock capable of accommodating tanker ships that can carry liquid CO2. We're already receiving shipments and intend to show that we can process carbon waste from Vancouver industry, as well as logging and mining businesses up and down the coast. Allow us to build similar facilities across the country and we'll be able to manage a large portion of our national carbon quotas. And with excess capacity built into the new coastal facilities, we can even bury American and Chinese carbon at a nice profit. The politician's eyes glimmered at the prospect of additional revenues flowing to the government's ledgers.
The technology.
It is perfectly safe, he asked.
We're not talking nuclear waste here, sir.
This facility was built as a prototype and has been operating flawlessly for several weeks now.
Mr. Prime Minister, it is a no-lose proposition.
I build and operate the plants and ensure their safety. The government just gives me the go-ahead and receives a cut off the top.
And there is plenty left for you?
I'll get by, Goyette replied, roaring like a hyena. All I need is the continued site and pipeline approvals from you and the Resources Minister.
And that won't be a problem, will it, Minister Jameson?
Jameson looked at Goyette with a beaten subservience.
I should think there is little to interrupt our trusting relationship, he replied.
Very well, Barrett said. Send me your draft proposals and I'll run it past my advisors.
Now where's some more of that fine champagne?
As the group made their way back to the refreshment tent, Goyette quietly pulled the Resources Minister aside.
I trust you received delivery of the BMW satisfactorily, Goyette asked with a shark-like grin.
a generous gift that my wife is quite ecstatic about. I would prefer, however, that future compensations remain less conspicuous.
Not to worry. The contribution to your blind trust account has already been made.
Jameson ignored the comment. What is this nonsense about building new facilities along the coast? We both know the geology here is marginal at best. Your so-called aquifer at this site will reach capacity in just a matter of months.
This site will run indefinitely, Goyette lectured.
We have solved the capacity issue.
And as long as you send me the same geological assessment team as before, there will be no problem with our coastal expansion plans. The chief geologist was quite amenable to revising his conclusions for a rather nominal price.
He grinned. Jameson grimaced at the knowledge that corruption flourished within the department well beyond his own dirty hands. He could never recall the exact day that he woke up and realized that Goyette had owned him. It was several years past. The two had met at a hockey game when Jameson was making his first bid for a seat in Parliament. In Goyette, he had seemingly found a wealthy benefactor who shared a progressive vision for the country. The political campaign contributions grew as Jameson's career advanced, and somewhere along the way, he had foolishly crossed the line. Campaign contributions progressed to jet rides and free vacations, ultimately leading to outright cash bribes. With ambition in his heart and a wife and four children to support on a civil servant's salary, he blindly took the cash, convincing himself that the policies he promoted for Goyette were just. It wasn't until he was appointed Natural Resources Minister that he saw the other side of Goyette. The environmental profit was just a cleverly designed facade, he came to learn, disguising Goyette's true predilection as a money-hungry megalomaniac. For every wind farm he developed with public fanfare, there were a half-dozen coal mines he operated, his actual ownership buried in a laundry list of corporate subsidies. Phony mining claims, forged environmental impact statements, and outright federal grants to Goyette's holdings were all jury-rigged by the minister. In return, the bribes had been steady and generous. Jameson had been able to purchase an elegant house in the upscale Ottawa neighborhood of Rockcliffe Park and accumulate more than enough cash in the bank to send his kids to the finest schools. Yet he never intended for things to slip so far, and he knew there was nothing he could do to escape. "I don't know how much more of this I can support," he told Goyette in a tired voice. "You will support as much as I need," Goyette hissed, his eyes quickly turning ice cold. "Unless you wish to spend the rest of your days at Kingston Penitentiary." Jameson physically wilted, accepting the reality with a weak nod. Confident in Jameson's indenture, Goyette's features softened, and he waved an arm toward the tent. "Come, cheer up now," he said. "Let us join the Prime Minister and drink a toast to the riches he is about to bestow upon us." Chapter 9 Clay Zack had his feet up on the plant manager's desk while casually perusing a book on frontier history. He glanced out a picture window as the thumping from the departing helicopter rattled the glass panes. Goyette entered the room a few seconds later, a suppressed look of annoyance on his face. "Well, well, my capital planning director," Goyette remarked. "Looks like you missed your flight out." "It was rather a cramped ride," Zack replied, placing the book into his satchel.
"Quite stuffy, as a matter of fact, with all those politicians aboard. You should really get a Eurocopter EC-155, a much faster ride. You wouldn't have to spend as much time trapped conversing with those prostitutes. By the way, that natural resources minister, he really doesn't like you."
Goyette ignored the remarks and slid into a leather chair facing the desk.
"The PM was just notified of Elizabeth Finlay's death. It was reported as a boating accident."
"Yes, she fell overboard and drowned.
You'd think a woman of her means would know how to swim." He smiled.
You kept things tidy? Goyette asked in a hushed voice.
A pained look crossed Zack's face.
You know that is why I don't come cheap.
Unless her dog can talk, there will be no reason to suspect it was anything but a tragic accident. Zack leaned back in his chair and gazed up at the ceiling. As Elizabeth Finlay goes, so goes the movement to halt natural gas and oil exports to China. He then leaned forward and prodded Goyette.
Exactly how much would that bit of legislature have cost your Melville gas field operation?
Goyette stared into the killer's eyes, but saw nothing illuminating. The man's weathered, slightly longish face showed no emotion. It was the perfect poker face. The dark eyes offered no window to his soul, if he even had one, Goyette thought. Hiring a mercenary was playing with fire, but Zack was clearly a tactful professional, and the dividends were proving to be enormous.
It is not an inconsequential amount, he finally replied. Which brings us to my compensation. You will be paid as agreed. Half now, half after the investigation is closed. The funds will be wired to your Cayman Islands account as before. The first stop of many. Zack smiled. It might be time for me to check in on my little nest egg and enjoy a few weeks of R&R in the sunny Caribbean. I think vacating Canadian soil for a short time would be a good idea.
Goyette hesitated, not sure whether to keep rolling the dice. The man did nice work, he had to admit, and always covered his tracks. I've got another project for you, he finally proposed. Small job. It's in the States. And no body work required.
Name your tune, Zack said.
He had yet to turn down a request. As much as he thought Goyette a cretin, he had to admit that the man paid well. Extremely well. Goyette handed him a folder. You can read it on the next flight out of here. There's a driver at the gate who will take you to the airport.
Flying commercial?
You may have to get a new capital planning director if this keeps up. Zack rose and strode out of the office like an emperor, leaving Goyette sitting there shaking his head. Chapter 10 Lisa Lane rubbed her tired eyes and again scanned the periodic table of elements, the same standard chemistry chart posted in most every high school science class across the land. The research biochemist had long ago memorized the table of known elements and could probably recite it backward if given the challenge. Now she gazed at the chart, hoping for inspiration, something that would trigger a new idea. She was searching for a durable catalyst that would separate an oxygen molecule from a carbon molecule. Scanning the periodic table, her eyes stopped at the 45th element, rhodium, symbol RH. Lane's computer modeling kept pointing to a metal compound as a likely catalyst. Rhodium had proved to be the best she had found so far, but it was wholly inefficient, in addition to being a horribly expensive precious metal. Her project at the George Washington University Environmental Research and Technology Lab had been called Blue Sky Research, and maybe it would stay that way. Yet the potential benefits of a breakthrough were too enormous to overlook. There had to be an answer. Staring at the square denoting rhodium, she noticed the preceding element had a similar symbol, RU. Absently twisting a lock of her long brown hair, she said the name aloud. Ruthenium. A transitional metal of the platinum family, it was an element that she had not yet been able to test. Bob, she called to a wiry man in a lab coat seated at a nearby computer, did we ever receive that sample of ruthenium that I requested? Bob Hamilton turned from the computer and rolled his eyes. Ruthenium. The stuff is harder to obtain than a day off. I must have contacted 20 suppliers and none of them stocked it. I was finally referred to a geology lab in Ontario that had a limited amount. It was even more than your rhodium sample, so I only ordered 2 ounces. Let me check the stockroom to see if it came in yet. He walked out of the lab and down a hall to a small storeroom where special materials were kept under lock and key. A graduate assistant behind a caged window retrieved a small box and slid it across the counter. Returning to the lab, Bob set the container on Lisa's desk.
You're in luck. The sample arrived yesterday.
Lisa opened the box to find several tiny slivers of a lusterless metal housed in a plastic container. She selected one of the samples and placed it onto a glass plate, then examined it under a microscope. The tiny sliver resembled a furry snowball under magnification. Measuring the mass of the sample, she placed it in the sealed compartment of a large gray housing that was attached to a mass spectrometer. No less than 4 computers and several pressurized gas tanks were affixed to the device. Lisa sat down at one of the keyboards and typed in a string of software commands, which initiated a test program.
"Is that the one that's going to be your ticket to the Nobel Prize?" Bob asked. "I'd settle for a ticket to a Redskins game if it works."
Glancing at a wall clock, she asked, "Want to go grab some lunch? I won't be able to get any preliminary results for at least an hour or so."
"I'm there," Bob replied, slipping off his lab coat and racing her to the door. After a turkey sandwich in the cafeteria, Lisa returned to her tiny office at the back of the lab. A minute later, Bob ducked his head around the door, his eyes opened wide in bewilderment.
"Lisa, you better come take a look at this," he stammered. Lisa quickly followed him into the lab, her heart skipping a beat as she saw Bob approach the spectrometer. He pointed to one of the computer monitors, which showed a string of numbers rushing down the screen beside a fluctuating bar graph.
"You forgot to remove the rhodium sample before you initiated the new test. But look at the results. The oxalate count is off the charts," he said quietly.
Lisa looked at the monitor and trembled. Inside the spectrometer, a detector system was tabulating the molecular outcome of the forced chemical reaction. The ruthenium catalyst was successfully breaking the carbon dioxide bond, causing the particles to recombine into a 2-carbon compound called oxalate. Unlike her earlier catalysts, the ruthenium-rhodium combination created no material waste byproduct. She had stumbled upon a result that scientists around the world had been seeking.
"I can hardly believe it," Bob muttered. "The catalytic reaction is dead on."
Lisa felt lightheaded and dropped into a chair. She checked and rechecked the output, searching for an error but finding none. She finally allowed herself the probability that she had hit pay dirt.
"I've got to tell Maxwell," she said.
Dr. Horace Maxwell was director of the GWU Environmental Research and Technology Lab.
"Maxwell? Are you crazy? He's testifying before Congress in 2 days."
"I know. I'm supposed to accompany him to the Hill."
"Now there's a suicide mission," Bob said, shaking his head. "If you tell him now, he's liable to bring it up in testimony in order to obtain more funding for the lab."
"Would that be such a bad thing?"
"It would if the results can't be duplicated. One lab test doesn't solve the mysteries of the universe. Let's rerun things and fully document every step before going to Maxwell. At least wait until after he testifies," Bob urged.
"I suppose you're right. We can duplicate the experiment under different scenarios, just to be sure. The only limitation is our supply of ruthenium."
"That, I'm sure, will be the least of our problems," Bob said, with a hint of prophecy.
Chapter 11. The Air Canada jet skimmed high over Ontario, the landscape below appearing like a green patchwork comforter from the tiny first-class windows. Clay Zack was oblivious to the view, focusing instead on the shapely legs of a young flight attendant pushing a drinks cart. She caught his stare and brought over a martini in a plastic cup.
"Last one I can serve you," she said with a perky smile. "We'll be landing in Toronto shortly."
"I'll savor it all the more," he replied with a leer. Dressed in the traveling businessman's uniform of khaki slacks and a blue blazer, he looked like just another sales manager headed to an off-site conference. The reality was quite different. The only child of an alcoholic single mother, he'd grown up in a ragtag section of Sudbury, Ontario, with little guidance. At 15, he dropped out of school to work in the nearby nickel mines, developing the physical strength that he still carried 20 years later. His life as a miner was short-lived, however, when he committed his first murder, driving a pickaxe into the ear of a fellow miner who'd taunted his family lineage. Fleeing Ontario, he assumed a new identity in Vancouver and drifted into the drug trade. His strength and toughness were put to use as an enforcer for a major local methamphetamine trafficker named the Swede. The money came easily, but Zack treated it with an unusual intelligence. A self-taught man, he read voraciously and judiciously studied business and finance. Rather than blowing his ill-gotten gains on flashy women and exotic cars like his cohorts did, he shrewdly invested in stocks and real estate. His lucrative drug career, however, was cut short in an ambush. It wasn't the police, but a Hong Kong supplier looking to expand control of the market. The Swede and his escorts were gunned down during a nighttime deal in Vancouver's rambling Stanley Park. Zack managed to duck the fire and disappear unscathed into a maze of hedges. He bided his time for revenge, spending weeks staking out a luxury yacht leased by the Chinese syndicate, setting off a timed explosive charge. Using knowledge gleaned from his days in the nickel mines, he blew up the boat with all of the Hong Kong associates aboard. Watching from a small speedboat as the fireball erupted, he saw a man on an adjacent yacht get thrown into the water by the concussion. Realizing the authorities would spend little time investigating the death of a known drug dealer, but might expand the dragnet if a wealthy socialite was an added victim, he quickly sped over and fished the unconscious man out of the water. When a sputtering Mitchell Goyette came to, his gratitude was uncharacteristically effusive.
"You saved my life," he coughed. "I will reward you for that."
"Give me a job instead," Zack said.
Zack enjoyed a huge laugh when he reminded Goyette of the whole story years later. Even Goyette conceded the humor in it. By then, the mogul had come to admire the subversive talents of the former miner, employing him as a high-level enforcer once again. But Goyette knew Zack's loyalty was based solely on cash, and he always kept a wary eye on him. For his part, Zack enjoyed being the lone wolf. He had influence with Goyette, and while he enjoyed the compensation, he also enjoyed tweaking his rich and powerful employer. The plane landed at Toronto's Lester B. Pearson International Airport a few minutes ahead of schedule. Shaking off the effect of the in-flight martinis, Zack stepped out of the first-class compartment and headed to the rental car counter while waiting for his bags to unload. Taking the keys to a beige four-door sedan, he drove south, skirting the western shoreline of Lake Ontario. Cruising the lakefront expressway for another 70 miles, he exited at a sign reading Niagara. A mile below the famous falls, he crossed the Rainbow Bridge and entered the state of New York, handing the immigration officer a phony Canadian passport. Turning past the falls, it was just a short drive south to Buffalo. He found the city airport in plenty of time to catch a half-empty 767 to Washington, D.C., flying under yet another assumed name, this time with a phony American identification. Dusk had fallen as the jet crossed over the Potomac River on its final approach to Reagan National Airport. It was Zack's first time in the nation's capital, and he duly stared at the city's monuments from the back of a cab. Watching the blinking red lights atop the Washington Monument, he idly wondered if George would have deemed the towering obelisk an absurdity. Checking in at the Mayflower Hotel, he perused the file that Goyette had given him, then rode the elevator down to the wood-paneled Town and Country Lounge on the lobby floor. Finding a quiet corner booth, he ordered a martini and checked his watch. At 7:15, a thin man with an unkempt beard approached the table.
"Mr. Jones?" he asked, eyeing Zack nervously. Zack gave the man a weak smile.
"Yes. Please sit down," Zack replied.
"I'm Hamilton. Bob Hamilton, from the GWU Environmental Research and Technology Lab," the man said quietly. He stared at Zack with trepidation, then took a deep breath and slid tentatively into the booth.
Chapter 12. A miracle of sorts arrived on the president's desk shortly after his meeting with Sandecker. It was another letter from the Canadian Prime Minister, offering a potential solution to the growing crisis. A major natural gas field had quietly been discovered last year, the Prime Minister wrote, in a remote section of the Canadian Arctic. Preliminary explorations indicated that the site, located in Viscount Melville Sound, could prove to be one of the richest reserves of natural gas in the world. The privately held firm that made the discovery already had a fleet of tanker ships online to transport the gas to America. It was just the tonic the president was seeking to help boost his broader objectives. A major purchase agreement was quickly put in place to get the gas flowing. The market price was exceeded, the company promised to provide all the gas it could deliver. Or so guaranteed the CEO of the private exploration firm, one Mitchell Goyette. Ignoring the pleas from his economic and political advisors that he was being too brash, the president quickly acted on the news. In a nationally televised address from the Oval Office, he outlined his ambitious plans to the public. "My fellow Americans, we are living in a moment of great peril," he said into the cameras, his normally upbeat mood masked by solemnity. "Our daily lives are imperiled by a crisis of energy, while our very future existence is threatened by a crisis of the environment. Our dependency on foreign oil has created damaging economic consequences that we all feel, while promoting the emission of dangerous greenhouse gases. Troubling new evidence continues to show that we are losing the battle against global warming. For our own security and the safety of the entire world, I am hereby directing that the United States achieve a national goal of carbon neutrality by the year 2020. While some may call this objective drastic or even impossible to attain, we have no other choice. I call tonight for a crash research effort by private industry, academic institutions, and our own government agencies to solve our energy needs through alternative fuels and renewable sources. Oil cannot and will not be the fuel that powers our future economy. A funding package will be presented to Congress shortly, outlining our specific investments in new research and technology. With the proper resources and a determined will, I am confident that we can reach this goal together. Nevertheless, we must make sacrifices today to cut our emissions and reduce our reliance on oil, which continues to choke our economy. Due to the recent availability of natural gas supplies, I am directing that all of our domestic coal and oil-fired power plants be converted to natural gas within 2 years. I am pleased to announce tonight that President Zhen of China has agreed to impose similar mandates in his country. In addition, I will be presenting plans shortly for our nation's automakers to accelerate the production of natural gas and hybrid electric-powered vehicles, which I hope will be adopted at the international level. We are facing difficult times, but with your support we can reach a more secure tomorrow. Thank you. As the cameras turned off, the president's chief of staff, a short, balding man named Charles Meade, approached Ward.
Excellent job, sir. I believe it was an effective speech, and it ought to pacify the anti-coal fanatics and their proposed boycott.
Thanks, Charlie. I believe you were right, the president said. It was quite effective. Effective, that is, at eliminating any chance at my being re-elected, he added with a twisted grin.
Chapter 13. Room 2318 of the Rayburn House office building was uncharacteristically packed with reporters and spectators. Open hearings of the House Subcommittee on Energy and the Environment seldom drew more than a handful of onlookers. But in light of the president's mandate on greenhouse gas emissions, the resulting media firestorm brought a flurry of attention to the subcommittee and its previously scheduled hearing. Its topic?
the status of new technologies to aid the battle against global warming. The assembled crowd slowly hushed as an anteroom door opened and 18 members of Congress filed to their respective seats on the dais. The last member to enter was an attractive woman with cinnamon-colored hair. She was dressed in a deep purple Prada jacket and skirt, which nearly matched the hue of her violet eyes. Lauren Smith, devoted congresswoman from Colorado's 7th District, had never traded away her femininity since arriving at the blue-suited halls of Congress years before. Even in her 40s, she still made a smart and stylish appearance, but her colleagues had learned long ago that Lauren's beauty and fashion sense did nothing to lessen her skill and intelligence in the political arena. Walking gracefully to the center of the dais, she took her seat next to a plump, white-haired congressman from Georgia who chaired the committee. "I call this here into order," he brayed with a thick accent. "Given the public interest in our topic, I will forego opening remarks today and invite our first speaker to testify." He turned and gave a quick wink to Lauren, who smiled in return. Longtime colleagues and friends, despite sitting on different sides of the aisle, they were among a rare minority of House members who shunned partisan grandstanding in order to focus on the good of the country. A succession of industry and academic leaders took turns testifying on the latest advances in energy alternatives that emitted zero carbon. While offering up sunny long-term prospects, every speaker wavered when pressed by the committee to provide an immediate technological solution. "Volume production of hydrogen hasn't been perfected yet," testified one expert. "Even if every man, woman, and child in the country had a hydrogen fuel cell car, there wouldn't be enough hydrogen available to power a fraction of them."
"How far off are we?" asked a representative from Missouri.
"Probably 10 years," the witness replied. A ripple of murmurs quickly spread across the gallery. The story was the same from each spokesperson. Advances in technology and product improvements were hitting the marketplace, but the progress was being made in baby steps, not leaps and bounds. There was no imminent breakthrough that would satisfy the president's mandate and save the country and the world from the physical and economic devastation of accelerated global warming. The final speaker was a short, bespectacled man who headed up the GWU Environmental Research and Technology Lab in suburban Maryland. Lauren leaned forward and smiled as she recognized Lisa Lane taking a seat next to Dr. Horace Maxwell. After the lab director made a preliminary statement, Lauren jumped in with the initial questioning.
"Dr. Maxwell, your lab is at the forefront of alternate fuels research. Can you tell us what technological advances we might expect from your work in the near term?"
Maxwell nodded before speaking in a hen-like voice.
"We have several outstanding research programs in solar energy, biofuels, and hydrogen synthesis. But in answer to your question, I'm afraid we have no imminent product development that will satisfy the president's tough new mandate."
Lauren noticed Lisa bite her lip at Maxwell's last remark. The rest of the House panel took over and grilled Maxwell for another hour, but it was clear there was to be no noteworthy revelation. The president had gone out on a limb to challenge the brightest minds of industry and academia to solve the energy problem, but he was clearly striking out. As the hearing was adjourned and the reporters rushed out of the chamber to file their stories, Lauren stepped down and thanked Dr. Maxwell for his testimony, then greeted Lisa.
"Hi, Rumi,"
she smiled, giving a hug to her old college roommate.
"I thought you were still at Brookhaven National Laboratory in New York."
"No, I left a few months ago to join Dr. Maxwell's program.
He had more funds for blue sky research."
She grinned.
"I've been meaning to call you since I moved back to Washington, but I've just been swamped."
"I can sympathize. With the president's speech, the work at your lab has suddenly become very important." Lisa's face turned solemn and she moved closer to Lauren.
"I really would like to talk to you about my own research work," she said in a low voice.
"Would dinner tonight work? My husband is picking me up in half an hour. We'd love to have you join us." Lisa thought for a moment.
"I'd like that. Let me tell Dr. Maxwell that I'll make my own way home tonight. Your husband won't mind driving?"
Lauren laughed.
Taking a pretty girl for a ride is one of his favorite pastimes.
Lauren and Lisa stood on the north steps of the Rayburn building as a string of limos and Mercedes sedans rolled through the dignitary lane, picking up the wealthier members of Congress and their ever-hovering lobbyists. Lisa was distracted by the appearance of the House Majority Leader and nearly missed seeing a rakish antique convertible come barreling to the curb, nearly creasing her thigh with its high-turned fender. She stared wide-eyed as a rugged-looking man with ebony hair and sparkling green eyes hopped out of the car and grabbed Lauren in a tight embrace, then kissed her passionately.
"Lisa," Lauren said, pushing the man away with a tinge of embarrassment, "this is my husband. Dirk Pitt."
Pitt saw the look of surprise in Lisa's